The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they're easy, but because they are hard. Start by a win. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Wiggins. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Wiggins.
Good morning, everybody. At least it is morning here on the west coast of the United States. And my name is David Livingston. I'm host of The Space Show. Welcome to our Friday program. And I hope you will find it as interesting as I'm sure I will. We have a returning great guest with us from the UK, but I will give you more information about that in just a minute. First, a couple of very quick announcements. This will be a full Space Show program, so that's about 90 minutes. So do pay attention to the clock if you want to get an email in to our guest, or if you want a phone call, you got to do it while we're still broadcasting. That's always a key number, right? So don't wait until the last minute. Our toll-free number, if you do want to call us, is 866-687-7223. And of course, you can always reach us with email, and that is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we're here to take your email as well as your phone calls. So we appreciate hearing from you, and we, you know, look forward to having you as a participant with our program today. You can note that we have a newsletter that you can subscribe to. It goes out about 6 a.m. in the morning Pacific time, and it's free of charge, and it tells you what's happening during the week. It's not very lengthy. It won't clutter up your email box, and we're glad to send it out. If you want your name on it, and it's email, you've got to get me your email address. And the next time we go out is 6 a.m., this coming Monday, so if you're not on it and you want to be on it, please send me your email address before then. And note that everything we do is archived. We do have a store, and it's Space Show Logo Wear, and check the picture of Pepper the Husky listening to the Space Show, and that will take you to our store. All of our programs are archived, either as a podcast or an MP3 on our website. And then probably the most important part, and I say this all the time, is that the Space Show is a nonprofit, listener-supported radio program, and we depend on your support, your financial support, to keep us going, and that is crucial to us. As a nonprofit in the United States, if you donate, you get a tax deduction for your gift on the federal side. On the state side, that depends on the state that you live in. So you might want to check on that. And if you have any information about that and you want to share it, I'll be glad to add that in my announcements that I make for raising money on the Space Show. There's a PayPal button at the top of our homepage. That is the easiest way to support us. And you can also use Zelle. And if you are going to use Zelle, the email address that you're going to use for Zelle is david@onegiantleapfoundation.org. If you have any questions about that, don't hesitate to get a hold of me. And the best way to get a hold of me, of course, is email drspace@thespaceshow.com. And you can also use a check and mail it to us. That address in Las Vegas is also part of that PayPal button, but it's also on our homepage. So lots of ways to reach us and to donate if you're interested in doing so. And as I said, we are listener-supported. So I clearly hope you're doing so. We also have sponsors, and you could too can be a sponsor. You get your ad going across the home page. You can change it anytime you want. And on longer formats, we, if we don't forget, read your PR statement that you create for us. So I want to shout out to our great sponsors, Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Celestis, the National Space Society, and Dr. Chaim Ben-Arroya. If you have any questions or comments, please let me hear from you. And if you're interested, for sure, let me hear from you. So for today's program, Dr. Peter Haig in the UK is back with us. He has a most interesting blog. It's on Substack, planetocracy.org. He has his PhD in astrophysics from the University of Leicester in 2015. He studied dark matter and galaxy dynamics. I have worked with the, he says he has worked with the Institute for Computational Cosmology at the University of Durham and the Cavendish Lab at Cambridge University, where he developed new methods for analyzing radio interferometry data. His published work includes papers on astronomy, galaxy evolution, Bayesian statistics, and space radiation. He also has a professional background in software engineering. He was inspired by the success of SpaceX at reducing launch costs to become an advocate for human space exploration and space settlement. He blogs about all of this. I told you the name of his blog. We'll talk about more about that in a minute. And the last time he was on the show, he was working on a book. Peter, welcome back to the program today. Are you still working on the book, or is it completed?
Yes, thank you. I'm still working on it. I kind of put it on freeze for a little while because I had professional things and working on my Substack, but I hope to finish it this year.
I'm still working on my space show book. I know how that can go. It can sometimes be a nasty thing. Are you aware? I mean, you didn't know I was going to ask you this, but given your background, are you aware of this new physics paper that does have some UK authors to it, in fact, quite a few UK authors to it, about black holes and dark matter and influencing the cosmological expansion?
Yeah, I think it's about dark energy.
Dark energy, I mean, yes, I'm sorry. Are you familiar with that new paper that came out, I think, just a few days ago?
Yeah, I've read the abstract. I haven't got any further than that. From what I can gather from the abstract and what other people are saying, it's an interesting idea. I think that, in my experience, there's been more... there's a lot of neat solutions to long-standing problems. There are many fewer neat solutions to long-standing problems that are actually correct. So I'm going to have a read of this paper and then sort of form an opinion after that.
I'm working on getting some of the authors on the space show. We'll see how that goes.
That'll be good. I mean, I can understand that it's always good if you have two different things which you can't explain. If you can find a common explanation for that, it's really good. But the thing is, with the sort of the current accepted model of cosmology, which is called Lambda CDM, the Lambda in this case is the dark energy, and CDM stands for cold dark matter, it's a lot of the things you can do to fix the problems in one part of the system, they mess things up elsewhere. Like, for instance, if you do tweaks to solve the rotation curve problem with modified gravity, that completely throws off cosmology. And then they have to sort of make further tweaks. So, I've not had a chance to read the paper fully yet. My kids are off from school at the moment, so I've been doing parenting stuff instead of reading scientific papers. But I'll read it on a... get a chance, I think.
Well, hopefully you'll post a comment on your blog, and we'll get your thoughts that way about it. Listeners, Peter's been publishing some pretty interesting things, and you may not think they're space-rated, but I think they They are kind of space-rated. Some of them maybe a little more than others, but definitely space-rated. You have an article, it was from the end of the year, but I think it's still timely. Space for 8 billion people. The human population has hit a new milestone to the dismay of some. And we sometimes hear from those some that dismay. Great grammar there. But the expansion of humanity should be a cause for celebration, and you go on and on and on. Why do you think some people don't understand the expansion and why they think like the world expanding and 8 billion people is horrible and we need to pale it down somehow? What's wrong with that, with expansion, and what's wrong with 8 billion people?
I mean, I don't want to be like overly sort of speculating on other people's psychology, but I mean, the idea that everything's a zero-sum game seems to occur quite frequently. I think if you think back to when humans were sort of living in small groups in sub-Saharan Africa and they were living as hunter-gatherers, probably true that sort of, you know, if you had more, you'd probably taken from the group. And I think to kind of steel man the argument, I think there's been a lot of alarming things happening with the Earth's environment over the past 50 to 100 years. And there has been some action on it, but there's always been a sort of a constant discovery of new things going wrong. And in the face of it, a person might think that if human activity is causing so much destruction to the planet, that human activity has to be curtailed.
And you don't see that?
We probably have to make some changes. I don't think anything near as dramatic as the changes are being demanded by the kinds of protesters who are blocking roads frequently in this country.
Yeah.
There's groups arguing for net zero carbon emission by 2025.
Yeah, that doesn't look very plausible, right?
No, I mean, that would be the complete dismantling of industrial society, which would cause an immense amount of suffering.
How does space figure into any of this? I mean, and why is expansion into space frowned upon by a larger number of people than I would expect?
I think if you look in the long context, it's only been frowned upon really since the rise of SpaceX. If you go back to the 90s, the sort of left-wing environmental movement, they were very, very pro-NASA. I mean, in part because NASA was providing a great deal of the data that proves they were, in fact, causing issues with the Earth's environment. And a good example of this, I think, is Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy.
Right.
So he's like a really sort of progressive sort of California left-winger, and he was writing this very positive story about Mars, when it was thought NASA would be taking people to Mars. And he has really changed his tune since then. And he wrote a book called Aurora, which it's got some good literary qualities, but it's really quite negative on expansion into space. So I think part of it might just be that there's people who think that the human race needs to be sort of gathered together and told, clean up your act, sort out the environment, and they're worried that billionaires are just going to jump in rockets and fly off and leave behind everyone a mess for everybody else to clean up. But I don't think that's very plausible, really, because it's been frequently pointed out that any damage we do to the terrestrial environment, it will still be easier to live here than it will be to live on Mars.
Do you, you said you think it's come about since the rise of SpaceX. Is that because SpaceX seems to be bringing to everybody the reality of humans going into space, living in space, space settlement. And before that, it didn't seem very real because of the high cost of getting there, the kinds of rockets, the fact that everything was government-owned. Is that why you suggested that the naysayers are there because of SpaceX?
Yes, that's also part of it. And I think that the idea being made real and concrete for everybody has kind of focused it in. When it was very far off, there was no real pressure to discuss the matter. But then you have Musk standing up and saying, we're going to try and get men on Mars in 10 years. Then everyone has to also, you have to bear in mind, if you put Elon Musk in the headline of any article on the internet, it will get clicks.
Why do you think the upside of going into space and settlement, finding new resources, finding new benefits and technologies and manufacturing and new ways of doing things that stand a really good chance of benefiting humanity, why is that lost on so many people? Do people such as ourselves who support going into space and believe pretty much what I just said, do we do a rotten job of communicating it, or is there something intrinsically negative or alarming about finding ways to live better on Earth and take care of Earth in a better way by going into space that we don't see or understand?
I mean, I think the most likely, I think there's skepticism that it can work in time, that you have a lot of people believing that there's going to be, like, absolute environmental catastrophe within 10 years. By, like, 2030, it's going to be too late to do anything. And so, obviously, by 2030, there's not going to be that much. There's not going to be, like, a city on Mars by 2030. If SpaceX move really quickly, they might get, like, one expedition launched in 2029. But it's not going to make much of a difference either way down on Earth. There's also, I think, and sort of the darker side, I posted this on Twitter a while ago, I've posted a couple of times actually, that there's a certain class of people who want to keep humanity on Earth for the exact same reason that the Socialist Unity Party wanted to keep people in East Germany, that if you've got an escape route, you can't maintain control.
Interesting. You have a.
I don't think that's everybody in the environment. I think there's a lot of people who are genuinely concerned and think that space is a distraction from a very urgent problem. But that there's definitely a sort of a fringe that sees it as a threat to control.
You have a caller waiting patiently on hold. Good morning, West Coast time caller. Who are you? And where are you? And thank you for calling us.
Hi, David. This is John in Fremont, California.
Hi, John. Go for it.
Yeah. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
You're on your blog, I think your most recent post, which is titled The Universal Bureaucrat. Reference a piece by a writer in San Francisco. I don't know how to pronounce his first name. I think it's Macje. And his last name is Chiglosky, and he pretty much opposes human space exploration, and he is actually quite negative about Elon Musk, and he thinks that Starship cannot get humans to Mars safely. Would you like to address some of his concerns about life support, radiation, and microgravity, that sort of thing?
I discussed this in the blog at more length, but essentially he has failed to offer claims. He links to one paper on the radiation risk, and I'm guessing this is literally he typed what he wanted to believe into Google or Google Scholar and clicked on the first thing that seemed to confirm it. Now, this was a fairly... he's taken the sort of most negative, most pessimistic study on radiation and taken it as the central case. Now, the thing is, I'm not overly sort of blasé about radiation myself. I think it's a worse problem than a lot of advocates want to admit, but it's not this sort of like ultimate lethal showstopper that critics sometimes like to pretend it is. Really, the main criticism I have with him on the radiation issue is that in one hand he says, oh, well, this paper shows that you'd need a huge amount of mass for shielding. And then just later in the document, he has a go at SpaceX for laser focus on getting as much mass forward as possible. And he doesn't see that these two may be linked. That if we do, through study, find the radiation problem is very bad, then it's just a matter of building more shielding mass. And it's rapidly accelerating the amount of mass they can throw into low Earth orbit and onto Mars transfer orbit, then it's just what point, how much mass do you need to solve the problem? And the other thing you said is gravity?
Well, life support.
Again, life support, throw more mass. If you can have... You don't have to have closure if you have enough mass. We do have some closure on the International Space Station, notably for water, which is quite an important one because humans need a lot of water. I did another blog post on this, by the way. And the recycling machinery on the ISS, even when you account for the spares it's eating up, it's producing like a progress capsule's worth of mass value each year or so. If it's a question of either not closing life support or increasing the reliability of your closed life support with extra spares, it just comes down to throwing more mass again. As for the gravity, in this blog post, he simply said that you can't build rotating spacecraft. Just in like a footnote, he says you can't do this, and he's offered no evidence for this. He said he was going to do it in a follow-up piece, but that's never appeared as far as I can tell. So, I mean, if he's not offering any evidence for this claim, I don't really need to say anything to refute it, do I?
No, you don't. Another question. I noticed that you support a Mars cycler and have written posts about it, how it could provide like a 10x improvement in cost on Starship. Can you explain how that's possible?
And the current Starship architecture, you have to fit out the inside like a cruise ship because you'd be there for months. I know you're not a cruise ship, but you have to give a lot of space for people. And there's actually some animators on YouTube who have done some really nice sort of concepts of what this might look like. But if you're only on there for like a day or so, you can fit it out like an airliner and you can get a lot more people in. So... Is the difference it makes is that you are instead of using the spacecraft to send people on a 6 month journey, you're sending on like a day or two journey to catch up with a cycler, and then you can just get more people on the same spacecraft, spread the cost further, and there you go.
Awesome.
He also mentioned being able to source propellant. as well, because a large part of the cost of going to Mars will be you've got your one spacecraft, but you also have like 7 or 8 tanker flights that you need to pay for as well.
Right.
Guys, wait a minute. What, Peter and maybe John, since you're in the Bay Area and Peter's not, maybe you can maybe be a better responder. What kind of audience does this guy have for his writings? Does he have a meaningful audience, either in terms of influence or policy wonks or people that can move others? Does he have a numerically significant audience, or is he really marginal, just like huffing and panting on publications that very few people read? Can either of you assess his audience, who listens to him, who pays attention to him?
I don't know much about him. I just kind of did a Google search on him, and he, I guess, started a – he's a software tech person and started a platform, and he blogs on a regular basis. Certainly, if, you know, he's got a liberal audience in the Bay Area and California, he could have millions. But I'm not sure in the space community that he's got a big following. I'm not sure, though. That's just my take.
I think he's got a much bigger following than I have. So.
Okay. Well, you know, that's a shame, because then people listen to him and get incorrect information and draw conclusions, and it's based on phony baloney information, and it's too bad, because other people, such as yourself, John, the space show, many people who listen to the show, don't have an opportunity to counter what they're being led to believe. And I think, you know, people who read your blog and hear the space show will be able to counter it, but how much of that audience is paying attention to us, that's always a big question mark that I have. So, and I wish it were, I wish we got into that audience in a bigger way, but they normally, if they know the positions that the space show takes, for example, they just dismiss us. They don't even want to hear another opinion. I mean, if anything has to do with the Earth and climate and environment, they clearly want to dismiss us and not even listen to the program. I can't tell you how many times I've gotten emails from people saying, I can't believe you've got people on saying this, that, and the other, and it was so horrible, I just shut it off. I don't want to hear those people. I mean, so you can't even reach some of his market, probably, with another set of facts or other opinions, and I think that's too bad, but I don't have the expertise to penetrate it, and I'm really sorry about that. Peter, do you have similar thoughts or similar things go through your mind?
Yeah, it's difficult to avoid just talking in circles with a limited group of people who already agree with you. I think for my own part, I've got fairly good liberal credentials, I think, because I actually I stood for the UK Parliament as a candidate for the Green Party. This was in 2015. I put my money where my mouth is on environmental issues before.
Yeah.
I was an unusual part of the Green Party because there was a sort of a fringe of us who wanted to change their stance on nuclear energy, which is, like most Green Parties, they are opposed to it.
Opposed to it, correct.
But there's about, I'd say about a third of us in the party, roughly, who were trying to get them to shift on that, because at the end of the day, if the objective is to reduce or even eliminate carbon dioxide emissions of industrial society, it seems very hard to see how you can do it without nuclear.
Well, they're kind of learning that if they're open-minded right now, but that's beyond the...
I think there's a certain shift in opinion in Germany right now.
Well, there should be. John, do you have any additional questions about, or for Peter, about any of his different blog posts or anything else that you want to talk to him about while you're with us?
No, I'm looking forward to your new book coming out. I did a blog post on your mass value paper a while back, and I'm excited to hear more about that book. I'm really also hoping to get your take eventually on that paper on dark energy sourced in black holes. If this turns out to be, I mean, there's another theory that says black holes might be the source of dark matter as well. Smaller black holes that, you know, we can't necessarily see that are causing the effects of dark matter. So
sounds like machos. I think that's been observationally disproven. I think. Machos were a bit before my time.
John, are
well,
you there?
Anyway, black holes have quite a big role in the universe, and it's amazing, you know, how they affect star formation and galaxies as well as other things. And if it's dark energy too, it's quite amazing. So anyway, I'll get off and let someone else call in, David.
Thank you. If something else comes up and you want to call back, always feel free to do so. Thank you, John.
Thanks.
Listeners, you can call. John has vacated the line. It is 1-866-687-7223. Speaking of your mass value analysis, you compared SLS with Falcon 9.
Yeah.
And you wanted to know if Artemis is cost effective. So most of us, without even reading your article or doing any kind of analysis, would look at the price to launch the SLS and what it's capable of doing and just conclude intuitively that not only is it cost efficient, it's probably borderlines on the terrible. Talk to us about the mass value analyst and how you see SLS with the Falcon in a different light than what I've sort of just said as a shortcut around doing the math.
Well, I'll explain what I mean by mass value. This was a concept I first came up with around 2019. I published a paper on this in 2020. The idea is that at the time I was just like measuring mass to low Earth orbit as a metric of like how space programs perform, how companies like SpaceX perform. That has actually now become quite common. There's a bunch of people analyst groups, companies putting out graphs of like how many tons to low Earth orbit each party has put out this year and so on. But what I realized from that was that you can't encompass all space development in that because not everything's going to low Earth orbit. And you need some way to equate what's done beyond low Earth orbit, as well as some other things I'll get to, but into a sort of an equivalent in low Earth orbit. So the definition, in words of it, is mass value of a mission is the mass that would be required to be placed in to perform that mission using the most basic method possible. I sort of define the basic method as essentially it would just be using a dumb hypergolic booster to move it wherever it needs to go. And this also, This also encompasses any in situ resource utilization or recycling of materials you do, because they're other ways of generating useful payload. So you would count them and then sort of add up how much it costs to put that to wherever your mission's going. So, for instance, if you had a water recycling system on the Gateway space station, like the one on the ISS, you would work out what it would take to boost all the produced to net, and that would be the mass value being produced by the water recycler. So in the case of SLS and Falcon, the thing that sort of seemed unfair would be comparing it directly between the low Earth orbit performance of SLS and the low Earth orbit performance of Falcon 9, both because SLS Block 1 is never going to put anything in low Earth orbit, and because one of the features SLS has is it's got a high energy upper stage. It's the high energy upper stage of the four. And this will give you a lot more performance beyond low Earth orbit than partly fueled Falcon 9 upper stage. So that was the basis of the comparison I did.
So how do you handle or equate these differences? Is it even a fair comparison to work with?
Yeah, I mean the way I did the calculations was I took the mass of the Orion capsule, because what you're trying to do is you're trying to send this mass to for Artemis 1. I'm just checking now if I did it towards some distant retrograde orbit. Yes, I did. Yeah, so because Artemis 1 goes to a distant retrograde orbit, I worked out sort of how much it sent to distant retrograde orbit, and then said, well, if you were to just assemble a dumb booster in the L with Falcon 9 rockets and then use that to send Orion to distant retrograde orbit, how much more would that take? How many more launches?
What'd you come up with? What were your conclusions for the mass value analysis between the two?
I'm just looking at the blog post now. I can't really get numbers, but I found that to match the mass value of the Artemis 1 mission, you have to spend $402 million on Falcon 9 launches. So that's about seven. There's about a factor seven difference. SLS is a factor seven more expensive to do this than Falcon 9, which I think is a little lower than the difference a lot of people would intuitively get. And also, I did repeat the analysis for Block 1B SLS. The big, big if they can keep the price per launch the same, that would only be 4.6 times as expensive.
Do you pass judgment on whether that should kill the Artemis program or not? Or you just say, here's how much more expensive it would be if Falcon 9 were doing this mission, and you don't pass judgment on it?
I'm not passing judgment. I kind of am making a judgment, but my view is that even at the higher price, I don't think SLS should be cancelled. I don't think Artemis definitely should not be cancelled. It's not really my call, because it's not my taxpayer money mostly paying for it. The UK does contribute to ESA, less than we ought to, but we do. And ESA did build the service module on the Orion. But I think sort of my tax contribution has been homeopathically diluted by the time it gets to SLS.
Right.
But I think I said this in the conclusion of the article. At the end of the day, SLS does now fly, and until there's something that is also doing the same job, I sort of think back to the cancellation of Saturn Apollo, which is also very expensive, in favor of the space shuttle, which was going to be very, very cheap. And it was going to fly by 1978, and it was going to do everything for everybody. And they didn't look before they left, and it was, in retrospect, a bad decision. So, yeah, I would not want SLS, Orion, or Artemis to be cancelled at this point.
I have an email from Todd in San Diego, and Todd says, if we make an assumption that you're on board with returning humans to the moon, hopefully on a permanent basis, there is a lot to be said that if all we were doing was relying on Falcon 9, there probably would be no return to the moon plans. And putting humans on the moon in any meaningful way by the private sector alone is probably a long ways away. So whether it's costly or not, or 7 times the cost or 10 times the cost, at least the program exists, and we're going back to the moon, and I believe they will try to fulfill that mission. However, it requires a government rocket and a government program, none of which is cost-effective, nor will it ever be, but you won't have the program without it. Do you see some merit in this way of looking at the situation?
Yes, I think I do. I mean, the way sort of Artemis has been structured to sort of involve an international collaboration as well. I like that Europe is putting into this, and that also makes it more likely to endure. It survives a fairly tricky change in U.S. administrations, and other NASA programs have not survived much smoother transitions, so that's good. I think everybody who's interested in this field, including myself, has their idea of what the best program would be, but categorically all programs that actually fly are better than all ones that don't.
Obviously.
So, and there's also the sort of underlying assumption against SLS is that it represents an opportunity cost, that if it were to go away, there'd suddenly be $4 billion a year to spend on just paying SpaceX to do stuff or building dozens of Mars rovers or anything else that you would want from NASA. But I don't, as I understand U.S. space politics, if that money goes away, it's not going to be freed up in a general NASA slush fund for science and private contracts. It's just going to go away. So,
right, it might not
opportunity cost from NASA's point of view.
Peter, it might not even go into the space industry. For all you know, it might go to some social program or some
most
medical
likely
program. So this is a big misnomer. People think that, well, if you save $4 billion on launching SLS, that'll give us $4 billion for space settlement or for doing this or that. You may never be able to trace where that $4 billion goes. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think if you're sort of concerned from the point of view of an American taxpayer, and you're probably buying your government a car every year in taxes, you're probably buying the SLS program a cup of coffee. So it's not going to make much of a difference from the point of view of how much tax you're paying.
Probably not. It's a drop in the bucket, but it still is a drop. And but it has a lot more visibility to the public than the financial impact of it. So if you wanted to cut, there's a lot of visibility to say we're cutting this wasteful $4 billion rocket that is going to the moon for no purpose whatsoever, and we're cutting that, and a bunch of congressmen get a lot of kudos and credits for cutting $4 billion, but it's insignificant. It doesn't mean anything. But it'll be a headline that congressman da-da-da-da-da. Mm. You know, so yeah. It has more visibility than it has impact, and people know how to take advantage of that, unfortunately. I have another question for you from Lisa in Tucson, yep. Arizona. And she says, I'm looking over your blog. I've subscribed to it. I wasn't familiar with it before. Do you ever comment on policy issues like China and going to the moon, or NASA Administrator Nelson making all sorts of statements about being at risk for losing the moon and not even being able to access it because of China's policy? I'm trying to see if you ever do political commentary about China, Russia, but keeping it to space policy.
I do, actually. And it's possible if you've not seen it, then you may not have subscribed to the right one. I migrated my blog from WordPress to Substack. So Substack is it's planetocracy.substack.com is the correct place. And there are some articles there. I've not talked about China very much. I think the largest mention of Russia I had is a reaction to the ASAT test, which I found quite concerning. I will comment on political issues where they relate to space. At the moment, actually, I've got a post in draft about the state of the UK space industry, and I'm currently waiting to hear back from somebody who's proofreading that for me. But that's going to be a big sort of deep dive into UK space politics, essentially.
Do you think we are at risk, as Nelson seems to be saying, of China commandeering the moon, for lack of a better term, and thwarting us and others from accessing it or doing anything with the moon?
I'm not sure it'd be that dramatic. I think Nelson has probably got an incentive to rally the troops and say, look, we need to get this done because they're racing with us. If you look at the Chinese space program from the outside, though, they essentially wrote their manned space program plan in 1992,
uh-huh.
And they haven't really deviated from it. They went through the Shenzhou program, they went through the Tiangong program, and they built a modular space station. And they've been doing this at their own pace. There doesn't seem to be the sort of US-China space race seems to exist largely on the US side. It's sort of the people bring up China as a way to say, try and get everyone motivated and get them moving.
So I've just got a relatively recent email on this very subject that says NASA chief, and then it indicating this is a quote from him, free world locked in moon race against China. A race for the moon's resources has begun as the world's superpowers prepare to launch rival human lunar missions, the head of the U.S. Space Agency warned. For the U.S., commercial and international partnerships are the way to win the competition, Administrator Bill Nelson told a news source in Asia in a recent interview. China, for its part, is collaborating with Russia. It goes on and on and on, pointing out that this is like a race to the death almost.
I mean, the instinct of China's collaborating with Russia, I see. Well, for a start, and this is something else I said a couple of days ago, it's arguable that Russia doesn't have a space program. What we see from them is actually the Soviet space program. It's all hardware from the 1960s. They've got these persistent quality control issues. they're under tight sanctions. So if they've tried to sort of incorporate modern components in that they need from the West, those have gone away. The idea that China wouldn't even move the inclination of the space station, possibly they couldn't, but they wouldn't change the design or anything about the space station program to get right into an inclination that Soyuz capsules can reach. So they've obviously got some technology sharing from Russia, because you can see like the visible similarity between their space capsules and their station modules. But I think that now they've probably got all they need from Russia. They're now the senior partner, and I don't think they need much from Russia anymore.
So I would take then that you don't think that Russia's a big concern for the U.S., but China probably is?
I don't think Russia's a concern in space. I think the biggest concern I have with Russia in space is that they will retain significant ASAT capability after the rest of their space capabilities have crumbled, because then you'll be in a situation where they have no sort of incentive to not get into a conflict in space. They have no assets left in space that are useful to them, but they're still able to shoot down other people's satellites. And then the strategic logic might just be, fire everything you've got and try and get even up to like a Kessler syndrome if they could create that. I don't think Russia's sort of really a competitor in the space race. I think they'll end up as a junior partner to China.
Should we be concerned about China in space?
Possibly. I don't know that much about the Chinese space program because it is still a military program, and I don't speak Chinese, which is two fairly big barriers. They've presented some like designs for like low cost, partially reusable rockets, sort of Falcon 9, Falcon Heavy type things. They could potentially do a cheap moon program with, but those have been presented at conferences by Chinese engineers. I don't know exactly how much support they have from the government. If they do have a serious human presence on the moon, the fact that they're not signed up to the Artemis Accords could cause problems. I think Russia and China have interpreted the Artemis Accords as kind of the U.S. trying to impose its rules and trying to get the sort of circumvent the terms of the Outer Space Treaty that stop you claiming territory. I think they may be correct in that interpretation, but personally, I don't think that's a problem, because I think that the Outer Space Treaty is a little bit too restrictive on property rights in space. So they could make some trouble, but I think it's going to be quite a while before they're thinking about putting people on the moon. Unless, if SpaceX is very successful, there might be a reverse Sputnik moment, and it might suddenly sort of alarm the Chinese leadership, maybe, that they've fallen far behind, and then maybe they would do some kind of like rush project to catch up. I don't know. It's not at the forefront of my mind. I don't really see a very intense race going on at the moment.
You have another question. This is Harold is in Atlanta, and he said you briefly touched upon concerns and issues in the UK's space program. What is happening with the UK program, and are you totally separate from ESA or part of ESA?
We are part of ESA. A lot of people were under the impression that we left on Brexit. This is not the case, because ESA is a completely separate organization from the European Union. like Switzerland, for instance, is a member of ESA. They're not in the EU. So when we left the EU, that had no effect on our ESA membership.
Okay.
One thing I sort of do point out quite a lot is the way ESA works is each state has to put in a compulsory contribution based on the size of its economy, and as a voluntary contribution it can put in as well. Our voluntary contribution is very low. We contribute less than Italy, despite having an economy that's like 50% larger than theirs. And we contribute much less than France, despite having a comparable economy. Generally, the state of... We have a fairly decent private space industry. We've got a good section of the small sat market, but very little public investment. I think the total UK Space Agency budget is about £400 million a year, which is, I think there are single NASA projects that are more funded than that.
They have a national space agency, so if they've gone to the trouble to do that, why do they voluntarily contribute so low? Is space not important to the UK?
How much UK politics do you want?
enough to understand the problem, okay?
Basically, the UK is having trouble spending money on almost everything at the moment.
Kind of like
us. I think we have it worse than most other comparable countries because we have a fairly system of old age care. We have the National Health Service, which essentially, I don't know if you know this, but in the UK you just pay taxes and the healthcare is giving you free at the point of delivery.
Correct.
If you're ill, you just go to the doctor. If you're in, you just go to the hospital. There's no billing department. So it's always all paid for through taxes. But with the aging population, this means that these two items have just squeezed out everything else, especially because they've made some election pledges. All the three largest parties have all agreed on these pledges to constantly increase the state pension above the level of inflation. All these costs, it's very hard to argue for spending on almost anything in the UK at the moment. And, yeah, it's a difficult environment in which to advocate for space development.
What does the National Space Agency do? Do you have some kind of a robust program?
I think it works through ESA. I think the biggest program we're involved in at the moment is ExoMars. That's actually being assembled in the UK, even though it's Europe-wide.
Right.
We tend to sort of make sort of either small satellites or components for other people's big missions. Like we had the Beagle 2 Mars lander back in 2003, I think. The first soft land approved on Mars, even though it didn't work. It kind of landed, it had this sort of unfolding sequence, and the unfolding sequence only partially completed, and it left the antenna covered, so it was never contacted. But it was imaged from orbit, and it was clearly down on the ground, intact, and partially functional. But that was attached to Mars Express, I think. So, yeah, we are doing things in space, but they tend to be sort of smaller things. There's no like big projects initiated by the UK.
What is space like for the average UK citizens? Are they really interested in it? Are they aware? Does it inspire young people for engineering and science degrees?
There is a certain amount of interest. For instance, when Tim Peake was our first official government-paid-for astronaut,
right?
When he went to space, there was quite a lot of interest in that. There was programs on BBC. The descent module from the Soyuz capsule went on tour around the UK. And I took him to, I took my son to see it. It was in Peterborough Cathedral. So it was in this big, like centuries old Gothic cathedral, and there's this Soyuz capsule with its parachute hanging there. It was quite a sight. That was popular. I mean, I do actually recall the actual first British astronaut, Helen Sharman, went up in 1990. She did a lecture tour, and I, when I was at school, I went to see her, give a talk about her visit to the Mir space station. So when things happen, like I said, I mentioned the Beagle 2 probe. That was a big thing at the time.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, it wasn't big enough for them to pursue a Beagle 3 and try again. But never mind. But when these things, I think there is a public enthusiasm. It's just a difficult. It's always been a bit difficult to sell this in the UK because there always seems to be more pressing issues on the ground. But at the moment, that's the situation with Russia and Ukraine and the energy crisis that's triggered.
Yeah, you've had innovative space vehicle designers for space tourism, for rocket engines. You've got the British Interplanetary Society, which dates back forever, which is a leader in the field. And the list of accomplishments and of early spacecraft, space tourism designers, vehicle design. I mean, it's almost endless. Where did it all go?
That's a question that British people ask about every aspect of our society. I mean, you have to understand, we've been in a near continuous decline in relative to other countries since about the First World War. And this narrative of, like, what happened, what went wrong, this just keeps cycling up through the political discussion.
Uh-huh.
It's a bit depressing, really.
Well, I don't mean to depress you, but when I started the space show, I don't remember their names, but I had lots of early people 25 years ago, 22 years ago, on the space show from the UK that had single-engine type of tourist planes, incredible rocket engine designs, all sorts of things, and people from the British Interplanetary Society with great papers and great expertise. And
We did have a bit of a, in the mid-century, we did have a bit of a space launch program. In the blog post I'm writing, I've actually done a bit of research on this. In the sort of 50s and 60s, we started developing the Blue Streak rocket. And this was sort of a contemporary of the Atlas missile.
Uh-huh.
It was a little bit smaller, but it was quite similar. I believe the engines might have been sort of a licensed version of the same ones. And it also had that kind of sort of stainless steel balloon tank construction. It was quickly realized, just like with the Atlas, that this was not a very good weapon. It would have formed the basis of a fairly good launch vehicle like the Atlas. And in fact, there was a plan to either import or build under license Centaur upper stages to put on top of this. And this first flew in about 1964, the Blue Streak. It was a little bit smaller than Atlas, so we would have needed some SRBs to be able to lift the Centaur stage. But if you look at what Atlas Centaur achieved in terms of interplanetary flights, unmanned flights, it did a lot of very early exploration. And we could have been doing that in the 60s with Blue Streak Centaur or some other Blue Streak-based launcher. And then after that, the only launch we did try to use Blue Streak as the first stage of a European launch vehicle called Europa, but that failed every single time it launched, not because of the Blue Streak first stage. And then we only ever launched one satellite in 1971 on the Black Arrow, which was a much smaller rocket. It was basically a small sat launcher. And then that was cancelled by the government because we didn't really have that much use for a small sat launcher at the time. And then, so I think maybe there's, you may have been sort of speaking to a lot of people from that era when there was more going on.
You have a email from Joe in Volcano, California, and he beat me to the gun. I was going to ask you a little bit about this. The UK has a very attractive small satellite construction industry and two launch sites being worked on now. Do you think we will see another satellite launch attempt from the UK this year? And I've been covering Surrey Satellite. I mean, this is a little bit different than what Joe is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But they're a UK company, and they've been developing satellite companies in Africa. They've now got a strong presence in the United States. They've been rulers of a certain sector of the marketplace for decades. And yet I don't hear much about Surrey anymore. So in response to what Joe is asking you, will we see another satellite launch this year? And what's up with Surrey?
I don't know what's up with Surrey. I mean, last time I checked in with them, they were still a small satellite manufacturer, pretty good one. I don't know if that's changed at all. As for a launch from the UK, possibly, I don't know. But the Virgin Orbit launch, you know, arguably that's not counted as a British launch at all because it's an American company, an American rocket.
Uh-huh.
We just provided a runway and some liquefied gas infrastructure, I think. And this is sort of... What the UK government has done here by focusing on the spaceports is they've figured out the cheapest way to tick the box of saying we've launched stuff. Because all they have to do is they've got a runway which is already there. I think it's a disused airfield.
Right.
They put in some infrastructure, and then the American company comes in and flies a satellite. So they get to sort of say, look, we're making strides in space. We've done this, even though they spend very little money on it. We do have what's sort of a bit more exciting is the Sutherland Spaceport in Scotland, where you've got there's two companies vying for that. There's Skyaura and Orbex, and they're both sort of small satellite launchers, and obviously they'll be going into polar solar synchronous orbits from Scotland. So I don't think either of them will be launching this year. But overall, I think I'm concerned that the small satellite market is not going to do well in the next few years.
Why is that?
Well, because if launch gets a lot cheaper, then the sort of logic of small satellites becomes less appealing. Because obviously if sort of cramming all that capability into as little mass and volume as possible, that'll cost money. And if the price of launch, price of larger launches comes down, then it's good. People looking into getting capabilities in space, they think, well, what's the advantage of sort of putting more money into the payload when it's cheaper to put more money into the launch vehicle? And there's also, for many applications, dedicated small sat launchers are competing with rideshares. notably the SpaceX transporter missions. And one thing I've noticed from the way they're pricing the transporter missions, I think if you look on the website, like the price per kilogram is something like $69,000 or something. It's, it's a meme price. It's some variant of like $69 or $420, like it always is with Elon Musk. But SpaceX are offering meme-based prices for transporter missions, and that, to me, is a fairly clear indication that they've got the market locked up. That, you know, if anyone was putting any pressure on them, they'd be a bit more sensible.
Listeners, a couple of things. Fremont John has been posting some of Peter's work on the blog. I think he's put three or four posts on the blog, so make sure you go check it out and you see the articles. And we thank John for giving us easy access to them. Again, his blog URL for Peter, planetocracy.substack.com. And we'd love to get your phone calls and as well as emails. The phone number, once again, 866-687-7223. We still have time if you want to give Peter a call, and we hope you do. Email continues, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And then again, you can post a blog comment. And to do that, on our homepage, thespaceshow.com, go all the way to the far right for the upcoming show menu. The program with Peter is the first one listed. You just simply open that page, scroll to the bottom, write your comment or question, and hit send. And I will get it and then can bring it back up on air. But again, toll free, if you would like to call us, 866-687-7223. If you're in the UK or outside the program, outside the United States listening to the show, and you cannot call on the toll-free line, if you email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, I will give you the actual Las Vegas, Nevada telephone number. And if you have a calling plan back to the United States, you can call us that way. And I'd be happy to share that number with you. Just email me and tell me you want the direct dial calling number for our toll-free line. And that's another way you can reach us if you're outside the United States. Peter, where do you see space? And this would be on a global basis, not just a UK basis. Say commercial space or this effort to get humans into space in 5 years out and 10 years out, are we going to be slowed down because of global economic problems that different nations of the world are facing? Are some of the protest movements going to slow us down? Or are we going to plow ahead sort of full speed, especially with people like Elon Musk at the helm?
I mean, I think in 5 years, I think that's a reasonable timeline for Artemis to get humans to the moon. I think if Artemis hasn't done a landing by 2028, then it might be in trouble. I don't think that there's going to be that much impact on the space industry from global politics. I don't really have a strong prediction for what the world will look like in 5 years at the moment, because this year I think is going to be quite critical with the war in Ukraine and a few other things. But most governments I think will have changed over the next 5 years, so it's hard to see who'll be running the show. Like I said, I think Artemis will have succeeded within 5 years. I think that Starship will be flying pretty regularly, and I also think that there'll start to be some competition for SpaceX, like serious competition. So I'm very interested in what they call relativity. Is that the one? The one with the
correct,
the
yeah,
sort of smaller starship, yeah.
Uh huh.
Because they might find that their sized one is more practical. And also, as I understand, they've got a fairly advanced 3D printing technology. So if they can get revenue selling that for other industrial uses, then they've got a better chance of surviving. I think the smallsat and smallsat launcher industry will crash over the next 5 years. There seems to be a lot of excessive optimism. 10 years out, I think there'll be humans on Mars. Probably they sort of coin flip 50-50 that there'll be humans on Mars. And I think it's near certain that if they are, they will send them by SpaceX. I think there'll be a lot of people living in orbit. One thing I do anticipate is that if the Artemis program continues and there's another means of sending humans to the gateway, it might become permanently occupied. And you get a situation where, if you remember from, I think, November 2000, there's never been nobody in space. There's always been somebody on the ISS continuously since then. And we might get to the stage where there's always somebody on or around the moon at any time. I imagine we'll get that in 10 years.
Do you see the commercial side, the private side, sort of taking over on projects from the national, the government side, or what will be the role of the government space agencies in 5 and 10 years?
I mean, I think there'll still be a big role for government space agencies. I mean, if you look at, they'll still be the ones offering big contracts and undertaking big projects. So, if you think about where Artemis is going to go, if SLS does end up going away, it'll be because there was a commercial contract to send crew to the gateway or directly to the surface. So I think it'll be, there'll be big government projects and they will get things done by handing out commercial contracts. I think we're quite a way off from this sort of libertarian vision where the whole thing is self-funding. I still think certainly for the next 10 years, it's going to be a necessity for basically politically motivated government investment in space. And I hope I can persuade the government to increase our contribution to that.
I have another question from you. Charles is in Virginia in the U.S., and he says, we now have a space force, and we constantly hear about potential problems coming through space warfare like EMPs and satellites being taken off and losing communications and all sorts of different things. Do you foresee space becoming hostile? Do you think there might be actual space warfare or conflicts handled through space? What do you think the future holds for space and conflict?
I think the idea of like a sort of a peer conflict in space, like a sort of Star Wars style, like space dogfight, I don't think that's going to happen. What worries me is, what I sort of mentioned earlier, is states with no sort of real stake in space, but with rocket capability, essentially undertaking space terrorism, just like, give us what we want or we'll start firing ASAT weapons at your space station sort of thing. I certainly think North Korea could end up in that role. And if the Russian space program continues its current trajectory that Russia might end up in that as well. I don't think there's going to be any new conflicts in space. I think there might be just becoming another vector for existing conflicts on the ground.
Do you think it's necessary to have agencies like the Space Force? Is that something?
Yes,
And does the UK does the UK have anything like that?
I don't think that's the formal Space Force. No Royal Space Force just yet. But we do have a military space program. I think it's more sort of regular sort of sensing and secure communications kind of thing rather than they're not thinking about space warfare yet. I've listened to the Space Strategy podcast. I'm not sure if you follow that, but I've heard statements from people in the U.S. Space Force who seem to be keen to function more like the Coast Guard than any other branch of the military. They want a search and rescue mission, which if you want to have a lot of people in space, that sounds like a very good idea. Because as the way it presently works is, and this is being discovered on the ISS right now, or it's being noted on the ISS, is that every person up there has to have a seat on a spacecraft to bring them back down at short notice. If you want to put thousands and thousands and thousands of people in space, you can't have like a big line of Dragon capsules just waiting there to take them home. At some point, someone's going to have to bite the bullet and have people in space with no immediate means of return, just having the confidence that obviously there'd be like some return capability for emergency evacuations of individuals, but you presumably want the confidence that if there was a real sort of mass emergency, you have to get a lot of people out of space, you could deploy from the ground or whatever, some kind of rescue.
We're rapidly coming up toward the end of the program. I can't believe it, but that is happening. Have we missed anything? Have we overlooked anything? Have we forgotten to ask you about something that you put on your blog or that you wanted to talk about? This would be a good time for you to let us know.
There's one thing that did catch my eye this past week is the Blue Origins project with building solar panels on the moon. Blue Alchemist. Because I'm going back to the mass value analysis. It seems to me that if they sort of go sort of heavily down this route, and it looks like they've made quite significant progress, and you can sort of think in a few years when they get New Glenn flying, it might be the case that even if New Glenn, it will be much more expensive than Starship probably, but it could be that in terms of mass value, they could beat SpaceX, even if they're sort of losing on launch or not beating them on launch to low Earth orbit or to transfer injection, if they are using New Glenn to support these sort of manufacturing processes on the surface of the moon, they might end up generating more mass value that way for less money than SpaceX can. So I wonder if, I think a lot of people are quite snarky about Blue Origin because they've not got anything to orbit yet. But
right.
I'm sort of wondering if they might be able to provide some stiff competition for SpaceX from another angle.
Well, I guess for that we're going to have to see if they can even produce their rocket, right?
I mean, the fact that they've delivered some engines to ULA is hopeful. And if they can provide working engines for another rocket, then and also they've launched New Shepard before, they're not completely you know, just from a lot of the stuff, and they do seem to be actually making rockets.
Well, I don't know what their timeline is for Blue Glenn, but they got to start producing and, in my opinion, acting like a real company. I'd love to see real pricing and the ability to buy a ticket on on their suborbital flights, but that still seems to be based on knowing Jeff and what he wants for a specific flight. So I don't see it as being totally commercial, because people have no access to it.
I mean, I'm not convinced that there's much of a commercial market for suborbital hops.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I agree with you on that.
But also, like I said, they have recently won a contract from NASA for a Mars mission. Presumably NASA has more inside information on them than we do, and they're confident that they can get a rocket off the ground, or they wouldn't have given them... Well, you say that, but they gave Tropics to Astra, and that didn't work out too well. Presumably NASA has some confidence in the Origin's ability to launch a rocket.
I always think it's a big assumption to assume competence in the government, so take it all with a grain of salt, right?
Right.
Peter, anything else you'd like to share with us before we wish you a great weekend and look forward to talking to you on our next visit? We're down.
I think that's about it. Just like to encourage people to sign up for my Substack. I've got a big sidebar of drafts that I've not actually published yet. And I need to stop making excuses on that and get some things out.
Okay,
some interesting things coming up.
We'll look forward to them. And we want to thank you for being with us for the past 90 minutes. And we'll look forward to another visit with you down the road. And as I said, have a great weekend. And listeners, as we like to say all the time, Peter and everybody else, myself included, should be looking up as much as possible. And we want to thank Peter for being with us today and the Space Show, and thank those of you who called and have been emailing. And our next program is on Sunday. The schedule is up there, and we're sailing through on a regular Space Show schedule now. So everybody have a great weekend, and once again, goodbye from Peter David and the Space Show.
Thank you.